Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Kathy Kitts, and you're listening to The Resilient Brain. I was trying to set this show up today for you to hear another show that I wanted to send your way, but it looks like it didn't quite match up, and so I'm still learning the basic ways to offer you different options. So if you'll bear with me, I was going to, as a backup, do some excerpts from a book called Brain Matters, and it's by the author Patricia Wolf. And I don't think I've ever really gone through some of the structure and function of the brain. You may have heard little bits and pieces here and there, but I thought that I would offer you some of the information, you know, about just general what things are called and what they do and things like that. So I guess we're going to start with the cells, okay? So the entire body, the human body, as well as animals and plants and all kinds of things, are made up of cells. The muscles, linings of the intestines, bones, skin, and brain are all made up of billions of these basic units. Each cell or group of cells has a specific job to perform. The cells that constitute the central nervous system, the CNS, comprise the brain and the spinal cord. Along with the endocrine system, they provide most of the control functions for the body. Two types of cells make up the CNS: neurons and glial cells. And so we're going to look first at the basic functional unit of the central nervous system, the neuron. And I'm sure you all have heard of the neuron. It is the basic brain cell, but there's more than just the neuron in the brain. So neurons are found primarily in the brain and in the spinal cord, which is the central nervous system, and they number approximately 100 billion. So that's a really, really big number. And they differ from most of the other cells in the body in two major ways. First, they do not appear to regenerate on a regular program basis, as do most other cells. And nearly all the cells in your body, including skin cells, blood cells, the cells that form the lining of your stomach, continually renew themselves every few days or months. This is why your skin heals when you cut yourself and why when you break a leg, the fracture will usually mend if the bone is set correctly. But if neurons are destroyed through a stroke or other trauma, they do not regenerate in the same manner. But there's news on the horizon. And in fact, this is true. This was printed back when they were just making the discovery. And it says here, we have long believed that humans are born with all the neurons they will ever have, but recent research is challenging this dogma. Several studies, and it's been several studies more since then, prove that the adult brain does generate new neurons. So we aren't born with every neuron that we're ever going to have in life. We can go through a process called neurogenesis, which is the birth of new neurons, and that was new news about 15 years ago. They were just sort of sorting it out and, you know, making sure that trials were repeated and so forth. But it is true that we never stop growing new neurons. Of course, in the very beginning 5 years, this happens with greater speed than it does later on, and as we age, it significantly slows down. But the fact that we still can generate new cells is important because it helps with learning and it helps repair that are not working out so well. And and so on. So the second way neurons differ from other cells is in their ability to transmit information. Neurons communicate with one another and form networks by means of electrical and chemical signals. To do this, they need a different design from other cells, which is the third way in which they are different. In Greek, the word neuron means string. So then they show you a picture about how the cells kind of got their name. And they have a body that looks kind of like a fried egg with the yolk in the middle. And then from the main part of the white of the egg, that part's called the cell body, you have these branches that come out from there, and those are the dendrites. And then out of one side of the neuron will be this long sort of tail, and that's actually the axon, and that is what connects to another neuron. And the axon is the part that is covered with myelin sheath, which, you know, during the process of myelination is what speeds messages through the brain with greater ability. So it's a really important process, and it figures pretty well in the process of learning. So neurons come in different shapes, several of them, in fact. And some are shaped like a pyramid, and others look something like a giant sea fan. But regardless of their shape, most neurons are composed of a cell body, or soma, which contains the nucleus, thousands of short projections called dendrites, from the Greek word for tree, dendra, and a single axon, which is usually covered by a fatty substance called myelin. Dendrites receive information from other cells. The main job of the axon is to send information to other cells. The end of the axon splits into branches, each of which ends in an axon terminal or bulb. So they're all connected together, or they can be, and they can arrange themselves in different ways. But the basic unit is one axon connected to another neuron. The neurons communicate electrochemically by passing messages at the junction, which is known as the synapse. I'm sure you've heard of a synapse, between axon terminals and spines on dendrites or cell bodies. Now, we're going into a subtopic of the prenatal development of neurons, and this is pretty interesting because of the numbers. From conception to birth, an amazing process takes place called neurogenesis, or development of the nervous system. It is during this time that neurons are generated from undifferentiated stem cells to, from the neurons migrate from the site where they were generated to their final position. 3, the neurons aggregate into distinct brain regions. And 4, neurons begin to make connections among one another. So this is all before birth. If a child's brain contains approximately 100 billion neurons at birth, and it already has made trillions of connections, then it stands to reason that the fetal brain has been busy producing all those cells. And just think, if a child's brain contains about 100 billion neurons at birth, and they've already made trillions of connections, well, let's just say that each neuron can connect to at least 1,000 connections. So that would be basically 1,000 billion, or 1 trillion connections. Now, when you get up to the total number of neurons that the child will have before getting born, and even after they're born, in the human brain, they say that the number of connections in the brain is greater than all the grains of sand in all the beaches of the entire world. Or another thing, it's been compared to greater than the number of all the stars in all the galaxies in the sky. So, I mean, that's just an astounding number, and I always think, you know, wow, that's pretty interesting. So in the embryonic brain, cells divide to generate new neurons at the astonishing rate of 250,000 per minute. So let me just repeat that. When you're an embryo, your cells were dividing to generate new neurons at 250,000 new neurons per minute. So hundreds of billions of neurons are created, many more we will see than are needed. Next is a process called migration. The neurons travel to their designated places by aggregating into layers, clusters, and tracks, forming the myriad structures that make up the brain. As soon as this happens, the cells start forming random synaptic connections. Again, more than are needed. And by the way, since we are going live today, if anyone is listening and would like to call in to ask a question or make a comment, that call-in number is 602-753-1726. Again, 602-753-1726 to call in. So after they form these basic structures, as soon as that happens, the cells start forming random synaptic connections. Again, more than are needed. If the neurons fail to form enough synaptic contact points or migrate to the wrong place, they are pruned away in a process known as apoptosis, or programmed cell death. And I think we've probably heard of apoptosis in another category, perhaps, but it's definitely programmed cell death. So if they're not utilized correctly, or they are hooked up to the wrong synapses, or they migrate to the wrong place, they go through just programmed cell death or apoptosis. In her book, Magic Trees of the Mind, researcher and neuroanatomist Marion Diamond estimates that approximately 50% of the neurons that have been generated are pared away before birth by this natural cell death. The purpose of apoptosis seems to be not only to eliminate neurons that don't make the right connections, but also to strengthen the connections that are left and perhaps prevent the brain from becoming overstuffed with its own cells. Incomplete apoptosis may account for the astonishing abilities of savants, as well as being a causal factor in their deficiencies in other areas. After brain cells have been created, have migrated, and have been pruned, the neurons spontaneously start firing without any external stimuli. So that's interesting, you know, before they're pruned, those neurons just start firing by themselves. They're not really passing on a particular message because they haven't been born yet, but they do spontaneously fire, and they make connections, and in a sense, trying out their circuits to make certain that they work. Again, a pruning process will take place, although this time it is a whittling away of connections, not neurons. It isn't until the beginning of the third trimester that the fetus's sensory organs begin to mature enough to react to stimuli outside the womb. Susan Greenfield, in her book, The Human Brain, that it is also around 7 months in utero that the convolutions begin to appear in the outer covering of the brain. At this point, the fetus responds to detectable light levels and to sound. Yes, the fetus learns before birth, just as we may have heard before. And I often tell parents that you can begin, you know, at around 6 or 7 months gestation when you're pregnant. You can begin to sing a particular song over and over when you think of it, or let's just say every time you jump in the shower. And you will find that when the baby is born, if you start singing that song, they will turn their head so that they can actually look at you and hear you more clearly, because it is definitely something that they've heard before and that they remember. So it is amazing. And also a great thing to do at that point is to get a rocking chair and just every day, you know, do a little bit of rocking in there, because it makes the embryonic fluid around the baby move back and forth, which is a small amount of stimulation. And, you know, any stimulation is good stimulation, because it's creating more connections in the areas that are affected. So that's what I usually tell people that I've worked with. And so, yes, they learn, and a baby is born able to distinguish its mother's voice and odor from others, and can even recognize music it heard before it was born. And that's from Davis in 1997, that they proved scientifically that that was true, and why it works to sing to your baby before birth. Now we're going to talk about another type of cell called glial cells. It's spelled G-L-I-A-L, glial cells. As amazing as the formation of neurons and their networks is, this process could not take place without the assistance of the helper cells in the brain, the glial cells, also known as neuroglia. The term glia is derived from the Greek word meaning glue, so they're glue cells, which reflects a mistaken assumption that these cells in some way hold the neurons together. Glial cells, which outnumber neurons 10 to 1, are quite different from neurons. First of all, just being, you know, 10 times as many more than neuron cells, it's amazing. So there's, you know, 10 times the glial cells that there are neurons. But the major distinction is that they do not participate directly in electrical signaling as neurons do. You know, that's how they pass on messages, is through the electro and chemical signaling between themselves. But glial cells do some of their supporting functions, and they help in the process of passing on the electrical signaling. One of the primary roles that glial cells play is in the development of the fetal brain. So this is pretty important. Some of these cells, the radial glia, physically travel from their point of origin ahead of neurons and form a temporary scaffolding for neurons to climb. Huh, so, you know, without the glial cells, maybe some of the formations wouldn't be formed directly, and you know, so the brain wouldn't be able to function as it was meant to. So they form these special scaffolding areas for the neurons to climb, and special adhesion molecules on the glial cells guide the neurons as they migrate to their predetermined place in one of the six layers of the cortex, the outer covering of the brain, discussed in more detail later in this chapter. Yeah, I do remember, you know, they are going to, we won't get to it today, but in one of the future chapters, and you can look this book up online, Brain Matters by Patricia Wolf, but there are six layers of the cortex, and the cortex is Greek for the word bark, so it's kind of like the outer covering or bark of our brain, and they'll go through that in a later chapter. But according to Arnold Scheibel, former director of the Brain Research Institute at the University of California, L.A., the migration process can go awry and may produce conditions that show up later in the child's development, such as certain kinds of epilepsy, dyslexia, and perhaps schizophrenia. And that was research he did in 2000. Another type of glial cell, the macrophage, assists in removing the debris of dead cells following damage to brain areas. Still, other glial cells, the oligodendrocytes, play a role in neural maturation, determining when neurons are ready to function efficiently. These cells, again, the oligodendrocytes determine when neurons are ready to function efficiently. These cells lay down myelin, which is that fatty substance, a laminated wrapping around some, but not all, axons, which speeds the electrical impulse down these extensions. Myelin is light in color and accounts for what is commonly known as the white matter of the brain. You've heard of the white matter of the brain. So those are basically fatty substance, which is referred to as myelin. And the whole process of covering those axons of the brain cells is called myelination. So a fourth type of glial cell, the astrocyte, is the most abundant glial cell in the brain. Astrocytes have a star-like appearance, and I guess the part of the word astro might give you a clue, because that, you know, is related to stars. But astrocytes have a star-like appearance, and their main job is to maintain an appropriate chemical environment around the neuron. So they act as a sort of sponge for mopping up potentially toxic chemicals. Astrocytes also play a role in keeping certain substances from brain tissue by helping to form and maintain the blood-brain barrier. So astrocytes are helping to form and maintain that all-important blood-brain barrier. So they've talked about four different kinds of glial cells here, and let's see if we can basically go over the types that we just said. So one of them is called the radial glia, and they physically travel from their point of origin ahead of neurons to form that scaffolding. And another type of glial cell is the macrophage, which assists in removing the debris around the dead cells following damage to brain areas. The third type is the oligodendrocyte. That's a mouthful. Oligodendrocyte, which plays a role in neural maturation. Remember with the myelin, they basically determine when neurons are ready to function efficiently, and these oligodendrocyte cells lay down the myelin, and it helps the electrical impulse or message speed down the axon. And then the fourth type we just talked about was the astrocyte, kind of have a star-like appearance, and their job is to make sure the chemical environment around the neuron is good. They either mop up potentially toxic chemicals around the neuron, or they play a role in keeping certain substances from the brain tissue by helping to form and maintain the blood-brain barrier. So all in all, you know, at least four kinds of glial cells, which again, you know, are different from neurons, but they are in the brain, at 10-to-1 ratio of glial to neurons in the brain. So I don't think most people realize that. Now we are going into an area about the central nervous system and that structure that operates at the unconscious level. So a simplified look at the brain would reveal two major divisions. One, a relatively small subcortical system that operates at an unconscious level, processing basic survival tasks, and two, a much larger cortex that processes the conscious decisions and responses we make to novel situations not covered by the subcortical systems. The structures under the cortex alert us to a danger or opportunity while the cortex selects the most appropriate response strategy. So the structures under the cortex, which is that outer layer of the brain, alerts us to the danger or opportunity while the cortex itself selects the most appropriate response strategy. As we look at the brain and how it functions, we will see how interconnected these two systems are. But first, let's look at the individual structures that make up these two major divisions. Early in the brain's development, neurons begin to aggregate into regions. In the four-week-old embryo, the human brain is a series of bulges at one end of a neural tube. These bulges develop into three hindbrain regions, one midbrain area and two forebrain areas. From these six divisions will develop the 40 or so major structures of the brain, as well as all the smaller nuclei, ganglii, nerves, pathways, and canals that are essential for the central nervous system to function normally. The actual number of structures depends on how you organize them. The visual system alone processes 30 tasks, and the cortex has been divided into 104 regions called Brodmann areas. Let's look at the lowermost part of the central nervous system, the spinal cord. Each of the following structures is shown in a picture below, and they do have a medial view of the brain, which if you wanted to, you could Google medial view of the brain, and you could replay this show and kind of look at it as we talk about the different parts. So the spinal cord, running from the base of the brain down to the middle of the back, is a large bundle of nerve fibers, and by large, we mean up to about 18 inches in length for an adult. 18 inches is a foot and a half. So if you can take your finger, you know, your hands and spread them apart about a foot and then half again as long, that would be 18 inches. So that's a pretty long nerve. And they are slightly thinner than an index finger. Well, I didn't even think they were that thick, actually. What he's saying or she is saying is it's the spinal cord. Okay, that whole bundle of nerve fibers makes up that spinal cord, which is protected by the backbone, you know. So structurally, the spinal cord is an extension of the brain, and that's what is slightly thinner than your index finger. During embryonic development, both develop from the same neural tube, with the brain forming from the top of the tube and the spinal cord from the lower portion. So they're talking about really, really early in the embryo's development. It starts out off as what is called a neural tube. So it's a tube-like structure. And the brain ends up being from the top part of that, and the spinal cord comes from the lower portion. So the chief job of the spinal cord is to carry messages between the brain and the body. It does this by way of two major corticospinal tracts. So corticospinal, I just want to take that word apart and see what that means. Corticospinal tract. So it's a tract that is going from the spinal cord, so the two major corticospinal tracts. Okay, they're calling them the ascending pathway and the descending pathway, which are the two ways the brain and body talk to each other through these two major tracts, the ascending pathway and the descending pathway. The ascending pathway takes in sensory information such as pain, temperature, light, and touch from the body's sensory receptors and relays it to the specific brain regions that process these different types of sensations. This pathway also carries sensory messages about the position of joints and muscles to the brainstem for unconscious assessment of brain position and posture. The descending pathway works in the opposite direction, carrying motor nerve signals from the brain to the body's muscles to cause movement. The spinal cord is also able to carry out some reflex actions on its own, independent of the brain. Examples of reflexes are the knee jerk and pulling a hand away from a hot stove. The importance of the spinal cord is strikingly evident when damage to the cord occurs through either injury or disease. Depending on the locations and severity of the damage, the effects can range from weakness in the extremities to total paralysis, loss of reflexes, and loss of sensation. So they're talking about, you know, the reflex action of the spinal cord. And we all know certain, we call them knee-jerk reactions because, you know, they happen right away or your knee jerks up or down. But, yeah, if you were to put your hand on a hot plate and you didn't realize it was hot, boy, it would jump off of that plate because, you know, your body's telling you danger right away. And they're just saying that, you know, it can go to the extreme where you have total paralysis or loss of reflexes and loss of sensation. So now we're talking about the brain stem, which is really below the cerebellum. The cerebellum is this little area that does a lot with physical movement, and it is kind of, the word means little brain. And if you look at it, it does look like a tiny little brain. And it sits at the base of your skull, and that's your cerebellum. But underneath that, and it partly goes down into your spinal cord, is your brain stem. And your brain stem has several parts, and it actually ends up being part of the spinal cord. So the brain stem, located at the base of the brain, where the spinal cord begins, is one of the oldest parts of the brain in terms of evolution. It is made up of three main parts: the midbrain, upper end, the pons, which is the center area, and the medulla oblongata, which is the lower end. Now, the brainstem is sometimes referred to as the reptilian brain, probably because its basic structure is rather like the entire brain of present-day reptiles. Yeah, so, you know, the brainstem is like their whole brain. It's part of our brain, but it's the whole brain of a reptile. And let's see. Given this fact that our brainstem is sometimes referred to as a reptilian brain, it isn't difficult to guess that its primary purpose is survival. And that is the main reason for the brainstem. We wouldn't actually be able to be alive if our brainstem were damaged too much, because it's in charge of all of those automatic processes that we go through, like breathing, heartbeat, temperature of our body, things like that. So, the brainstem is largely in control of autonomic functions. These functions not under our conscious control, but essential for our survival, as I just said. The necessity of the unconscious workings of the brainstem is obvious if you consider what your life would be like if you had to consciously control your breathing, your heartbeat, your blood pressure. You wouldn't be able to think about very much else, because those, you know, take up a lot of our functioning. And the brainstem accomplishes these feats by means of a network of neurons and fibers known as the reticular formation. Now, this is really interesting, this part. I'm going to repeat that. The brainstem accomplishes these by means of a network of neurons and fibers known as the reticular formation, or RF, which occupies the core of the brainstem. So if it were at the base of your brain under the cerebellum and hooking up to your spinal cord, on the interior of that is where the RF is, the neurons and fibers known as the reticular formation. The RF receives information from all over your body. Every time your body moves, some adjustment of heart rate, blood pressure, or breathing rate is needed to compensate for the changes that have occurred. The cells in the RF are in charge of regulating these basic life support systems. In addition to controlling these vital systems, the RF contains other cells that control some eyeball movements, pupil construction, stomach reflexes, fetal expression, salivation, and taste. The RF is fairly mature at birth. A newborn's brainstem is already functioning to regulate its heart rate, blood pressure, and respiration. Okay, but here's the important part. Well, you know, thing that I think is so interesting. An equally important function of the reticular system is the control of awareness levels. Okay, the RF, neurons in the thalamus, and other neurons from a variety of sensory systems of the brain make up the reticular activating system, or RAS. How many people out there have heard of the RAS, or the reticular activating system? This is where you subconsciously, okay, say you just bought a bright blue Honda, and you go out and you start driving around, and you've never noticed these bright blue Hondas. Let's just say they're like a beautiful ultramarine blue. You've never noticed that color before, but as soon as you buy one and you've been made aware of it, your reticular activating formation, your reticular activating system, RAS, will help you to realize and be aware of all the other blue Hondas out there on the road. And believe me, you'll pick up quite a few, but they'll be everywhere as you progress. So whatever it is that you want to place your attention on, the RAS helps you to sort of subconsciously tell your body to look out for it. And so that's really important in the whole paying attention part. And the RAS is also important for the ADHD kids. This is the part that doesn't maybe function as well in some ADHD people. Now, according to Dr. Amen, Daniel Amen, who's written about 30 books, there are at least 7 types of ADHD. So there are some types that do better, actually, with some medication. There are some types that do a lot worse with medication. But they all have to do with the reticular activating system, and paying attention is controlled by that system. So that's why I thought it was pretty darn important. So let's see. This system receives input from the body and changes the level of cell excitation to meet the changing conditions in the environment. For example, if stimulation is decreased by cutting down sensory input, such as putting a person in a dark, quiet room, the RAS decreases the level of excitation in the cortex, and the level of consciousness is changed. The person may actually go to sleep. When the body awakens from sleep, the RAS increases the level of excitation in the cortex, and the person becomes aware or conscious. But whether we are drowsy, asleep, awake, hypervigilant, or unconscious, the activity of the brainstem continues to keep the life support systems functioning. Severe damage to the RAS, the RAS, can result in a permanent coma. So you want to be careful to not get a head injury that, you know, is severely damaging your RAS. So let me just say that last thing again. Whether we are drowsy, asleep, awake, hypervigilant, or unconscious, the activity of the brainstem continues to keep the life support systems functioning. And severe damage to the RAS can result in a permanent coma. Okay, so the RAS also serves as an effective filter for the thousands of stimuli constantly bombarding the sensory receptors, allowing you to focus on relevant stimuli. It excludes background information and tunes out distractions or trivial sensory information, such as awareness of your clothes on your body or the feeling of your back against the chair. It is the RAS that allows you to fall asleep on a plane, but to awake suddenly when the plane's engines change pitch. So this is the area that, if it's not working correctly to filter out these irrelevant stimuli, it might have you, you know, itching your neck because your tag on your clothes is bothering the way you feel. And you might have trouble with sleeping in general. A final important role of the brainstem is in the production of many of the brain's chemical messengers. These chemicals come from nuclei, close-knit groups of nerve cell bodies, located in the brainstem, and are projected widely to all other parts of the brain. We'll look more closely at their function in a later chapter. Well, that's an interesting final area that it's saying that the brainstem itself has an important role as a producer of many of the brain's chemical messengers. And, you know, we have chemical messengers that help cause a message to go over the synapse of two neurons. We have lots of chemicals that tell us, you know, different parts of our body to act in a certain way or not. So chemicals are very, you know, important for our being to be alive. And they're saying that the brain stem chemicals come from nuclei, which are located in the brain stem itself. These nuclei are the close-knit groups of nerve cell bodies. And those nuclei in the brainstem are projected widely to all other parts of the brain. So we'll look more closely later at this, or you will if you get this book. Although it might appear that the functioning of the brainstem, and especially the RAS, is rather primitive and less important than more complex structures such as the large cerebral hemispheres with their intellectual capacities. This is not true. In fact, because it is a rather small structure, damage to the brainstem is highly life-threatening, whereas damage to the much larger cortex may have relatively minor consequences depending on the location and extent of the damage. So you could say that this very small area of the brain holds the key to life itself. Well, that's a pretty significant statement, you know, that it is such a small area, but it does have a very important job at the basic survival level. And I'm going to take a sip of water. It gets kind of my throat gets kind of thirsty when I'm reading on and on, as you can imagine. So now we have a few minutes to talk about the cerebellum. I think we might be able to finish that. And the cerebellum, let's see, moving up in the system, we encountered a cerebellum at the back of the brain. It's Latin. Its name is derived from Latin and means little brain. Cera is brain and bellum is little. It is a two-lobed, steeply folded structure overlaying the top of the brainstem just under the occipital lobes. The occipital lobes are in the back of your brain and are the ones that deal with vision in the posterior portion of the brain. The cerebellum, like the brainstem, primitive in evolutionary terms and has changed little over thousands of years. In all mammals, the cerebellum is the key to balance, maintenance of body posture, and coordination of muscle function. Because humans have an almost unlimited repertoire of movement, the cerebellum is large, accounting for 11% of the body's weight. From birth to two, the cerebellum grows faster than does the cerebral cortex. And if you think about it, it's because, you know, you're learning how to creep and crawl, you know, get up on your hands and knees, or first be like a salamander along the floor, and then getting up with onto your hands and knees like a crawling baby. And eventually you get enough musculature to be able to stand and sort of cruise around furniture while holding on to the furniture. And after that, you tend to get pretty courageous and actually start to, you know, stand by yourself and walk by yourself. So all of that takes a lot of the neurons and the structures in the cerebellum. So by age two, it has almost reached its adult size. Wow. During this early period, the child is learning the basic movements such as walking and grasping. The cerebellum stores these movement patterns in neural networks and then throughout life calls upon them whenever they are needed. Coordinated movements such as walking, lifting a glass, or writing a letter. Oh, boy, I think I just saw a little insect ready to bite me. The cerebellum stores these movement patterns in neural networks and then, throughout life, calls upon them whenever they are needed. Okay. Coordinated movements such as walking, lifting a glass, or writing a word are activities that we often take for granted. The acquisition of the skilled movements involved in these activities begins under the conscious control of the cortex. Though the cortex can plan and initiate movements, it does not have the neural circuitry needed to calculate the sequences of muscular contractions necessary for the movements. Okay, because I do know that recent research has shown that planning to move and how we're going to move does take place in the cerebellum, and also even planning other things like how to study for a test, or, you know, how many times to review certain material, that also can be handled through the cerebellum. Though the cortex can plan and initiate movements, it does not have the neural circuitry needed to calculate the sequences of muscular contractions necessary for the movement. That task falls to the cerebellum. Okay? Oh, because the other skilled movements are under the conscious control of the cortex. So movements such as walking, lifting a glass, or writing a word are activities that we often take for granted. The acquisition of the skilled movements involved in these activities begins under the conscious control of the cortex. Sometimes when I'm reading, I don't understand it as I'm reading. Though the cortex can plan and initiate movements, it does have the neural circuitry needed. Oh, it does not have. So we're back to the cortex. Though the cortex can plan and initiate movements, it doesn't have all the necessary parts to calculate the sequences of muscular contractions necessary for the movements. So that task falls to the cerebellum. When the cerebellum receives information in about 1/50th of a second, wow, that the motor cortex has begun to initiate a movement, it computes the contribution that various muscles will have to make to perform that movement and sends the appropriate messages to those muscles. The action has begun. Throughout the action, the cerebellum continuously monitors and modifies the activity in the muscles, making the changes necessary for smooth completion of the action. These complex maneuvers are also necessary when a person is sitting or standing. Information comes into the cerebellum not only from the motor cortex, spinal cord, and muscles, but also from the organs of balance in the vestibular area of the brain. This allows the cerebellum to continually modify activity in the motor pathway, essential for maintaining the body in an upright position. So if you ever learned to drive a car, play the piano, or touch type, you probably remember what a long, laborious process it was and how many hours of practice it took to become proficient. If you still do any one of these today, it is likely that you can do it so unconsciously you would have difficulty telling somebody how you do it. You can think your cerebellum, or you can thank your cerebellum for this ability. What happens over time as the movements involved in playing the piano, I was asking a question, I'm sorry. What happens over time as the movements involved in playing the piano or driving the car are repeated over and over? We all know from our own experience that the skill becomes more and more automatic and that less conscious thought is needed to accomplish the task. Have you ever driven your car over a familiar route, arrived at your destination, realized that you were not aware of having driven there? The brain allows us to engage in complex motor activities with almost no conscious awareness of the task. With proficiency, the cerebellum takes over much of the control, leaving the conscious mind free to do and think about other things. How this occurs is not totally understood, although scientists have advanced several theories. One neurobiologist, W.T. Thach, T-H-A-C-H, from the University of Washington School of Medicine, suggests that the cerebellum may link a behavioral context to a motor response. He proposes that as you practice a motor response, such as riding a bicycle over and over, the occurrence of the context, getting on the bicycle, triggers the occurrence of the response, riding the bicycle. and that's from Thatch from 1996. In other words, the linkage between the motor areas of the cortex and the cerebellum permit an experiential context to automatically evoke an action. Recently, researchers have also become interested in the functions of the cerebellum that do not deal specifically with motor functions. Blood flow and anatomical studies have shown close links between the frontal core, the frontal cortex, and the cerebellum. Perhaps we'll find that the cerebellum plays a major role in cognition, such as planning or imagining movements, which it does, as well as in the movements themselves. Very true. Now, in the 2 minutes that remain, I don't want to start the next segment, which is on thalamus and hypothalamus, but I think I'll just read through the various parts that we'll be covering if I read through this part again. After the thalamus and hypothalamus, both of which, by the way, are in the sort of the center of the brain, and they kind of act like a central receiving area. They take in all the incoming sense messages and then reroute them to the brain part or the part of the body that needs to know, you know, to move or have an action done. After that, they go into a little bit of the amygdala. The amygdala is a very interesting part of the body. It's part of the limbic system, which is the emotional system, and it's responsible for a lot of things, but most importantly is the fight or flight response. And I should say fight, flight, or freeze, because sometimes, you know, you're supposed to fight or flight, but you can't do anything, so you freeze. Yeah, so those are located in the limbic system, and it's right next to the hippocampus, which has a lot to do with the with the memory storage. And it basically takes in memory, and it's sort of like short-term memory, working memory. And then when you sleep, this very important function happens where it consolidates the information and turns it into long-term memory. So you really must do a certain amount of sleeping every day so that your memory can function correctly and can form as it is necessary. But as we're finishing up this this show, I just wanted to say thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to The Resilient Brain, and we come to you every Saturday at noon. And I hope that you have a great rest of the weekend and that you, you know, treat your brain wisely so that it can remain resilient, okay? So thank you very much, and we'll be with you again next week. Bye now.